A Separate Piece, Disc 2.
Everyone has a moment in history which belongs particularly to him. It is the moment when his emotions achieve their most powerful sway over him. And afterward, when you say to this person, "The world today," or "life," or "reality," he'll assume that you mean this moment, even if it's 50 years past. The world, through his unleashed emotions, imprinted itself upon him, and he carries the stamp of that passing moment forever. For me, this moment, 4 years is a moment in history, was the war. The war was and is reality for me. I still instinctively live and think in its atmosphere. These are some of its characteristics. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the President of the United States, and he always has been. The other two eternal world leaders are Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. America is not, and never has been, and never will be what the songs and poems call it, a land of plenty. Nylon, meat, gasoline, and steel are rare. There are too many jobs and not enough workers. Money is very easy to earn, but rather hard to spend because there isn't very much to buy. Trains are always late and always crowded with servicemen. The war will always be fought very far from America, and it will never end. Nothing in America stands still for very long, including the people, who are always either leaving or on leave. People in America cry often. 16 is the key and crucial and natural age for a human being to be, and people of all other ages are ranged in an orderly manner ahead of and behind you as a harmonious setting for the 16-year-olds of this world. When you're 16, adults are slightly impressed and almost intimidated by you. This is a puzzle, finally solved by the realization that they foresee your military future, fighting for them. You do not foresee it. To waste anything in America is immoral. String and tinfoil are treasures. Newspapers are always crowded with strange maps and names of towns, and every few months the earth seems to lurch from its path when you see something in the newspapers, such as the time Mussolini, who had almost seemed one of the eternal leaders, is photographed hanging upside down on a meat hook. Everyone listens to the news broadcasts 5 or 6 times every day. All pleasurable things, all travel and sports and entertainment and good food and fine clothes, are in the very shortest supply, always were, and always will be. There are just tiny fragments of pleasure and luxury in the world, and there's something unpatriotic about enjoying them. All foreign lands are inaccessible except to servicemen. They're vague, distant, and sealed off as though behind a curtain of plastic. The prevailing color of life in America is a dull, dark green called olive drab. That color is always respectable and always important. Most other colors risk being unpatriotic. It's this special America, a very untypical one, I guess, an unfamiliar transitional blur in the memories of most people, which is the real America for me. In that short-lived and special country, we spent this summer at Devon, when Finney achieved certain feats as an athlete. In such a period, no one notices or rewards any achievements involving the body unless the result is to kill it or save it on the battlefield, so that there were only a few of us to applaud and wonder at what he was able to do. One day, he broke the school swimming record. He and I were fooling around in the pool, near a big bronze plaque marked with the events for which the school kept records. 50 yards, 100 yards, 220 yards. Under each was a slot with a marker fitted into it, showing the name of the record holder, his year, and his time. Under 100 yards freestyle, there was A. Hopkins Parker, 1940, 53.0 seconds. A. Hopkins Parker, Finney squinted up at the name. I don't remember any A. Hopkins Parker. He graduated before we got here.
You mean that record has been up there the whole time we've been at Devon and nobody's busted it yet?
It was an insult to the class, and Finney had tremendous loyalty to the class, as he did to any group he belonged to, beginning with him and me, and radiating outward past the limits of humanity, toward spirits and clouds and stars. No one else happened to be in the pool. Around us gleamed white tile and glass brick. The green, artificial-looking water rocked gently in its shining basin, releasing vague chemical smells and a sense of many pipes and filters. Even Finney's voice, trapped in this closed, high-ceilinged room, lost its special resonance and blurred into a general well of noise gathered up toward the ceiling. He said blurringly, "I have a feeling I can swim faster than A. Hopkins Parker." We found a stopwatch in the office. He mounted a starting box, leaned forward from the waist as he'd seen racing swimmers do, but never had occasion to do himself. I noticed a preparatory looseness coming into his shoulders and arms, a controlled ease about his stance which was unexpected in anyone trying to break a record. I said, "On your mark, go." There was a complex moment when his body uncoiled and shot forward with sudden metallic tension. He planed up the pool, his shoulders dominating the water while his legs and feet rode so low that I couldn't distinguish them. A wake rippled hurriedly by him, and then, at the end of the pool, his position broke, he relaxed, dived, an instant's confusion, and then his suddenly and metallically tense body shot back toward the other end of the pool. Another turn, and up the pool again. I noticed no particular slackening of his pace. Another turn, down the pool again. His hand touched the end, and he looked up at me with a composed, interested expression.
"Well, how did I do?"
I looked at the watch. He'd broken A. Hopkins Parker's record by 0.7 second.
"My God, so I really did it. You know what? I thought I was going to do it. I felt as though I had that stopwatch in my head and I could hear myself going just a little bit faster than A. Hopkins Parker. Oh, the worst thing is there aren't any witnesses. I'm no official timekeeper. I don't think it'll count."
"Well, of course it won't count."
"You can try it again and break it again. Tomorrow. We'll get the coach in here and all the official timekeepers, and I'll call the Devonian to send a reporter and a photographer."
He climbed out of the pool. "I'm not going to do it again," he said quietly.
"Of course you are."
"No, I just wanted to see if I could do it. Now I know. But I don't want to do it in public."
Some other swimmers drifted in through the door. Finney glanced sharply at them.
"By the way," he said in an even more subdued voice, "we aren't going to talk about this. It's just between you and me. Don't say anything about it to anyone."
"Not say anything about it? When you broke the school record?"
"Shh!" He shot a blazing, agitated glance at me. I stopped and looked at him, up and down. He didn't look directly back at me.
"You're too good to be true," I said after a while.
He glanced at me and then said, "Thanks a lot," in a somewhat expressionless voice.
Was he trying to impress me or something? Not tell anybody? When he'd broken a school record without a day of practice?
I knew he was serious about it, so I didn't tell anybody. Perhaps for that reason, his accomplishment took root in my mind and grew rapidly in the darkness where I was forced to hide it. The Devon school record books contained a mistake, a lie, and nobody knew it but Finney and me. A. Hopkins Parker was living in a fool's paradise wherever he was. His defeated name remained in bronze on the school record plaque, while Finney deliberately evaded an athletic honor. It was true that he had many already. The Winslow Galbraith Memorial Football Trophy for having brought the most Christian sportsmanship to the game during the 1941-1942 season, The Margaret Duke Bonaventura ribbon and prize for the student who conducted himself at hockey most like the way her son had done. The Devon School Contact Sport Award, presented each year to that student who, in the opinion of the athletic advisors, excels his fellows in the sportsmanlike performance of any game involving bodily contact.
But these were in the past. They were prizes, not school records. The sports Finney played officially, football, hockey, baseball, lacrosse, didn't have school records. To switch to a new sport suddenly, just for a day, and immediately break a record in it. That was about as neat a trick, as dazzling a reversal as I could, to be perfectly honest, possibly imagine. There was something inebriating in the suppleness of this feat. When I thought about it, my head felt a little dizzy and my stomach began to tingle. It had, in one word, glamour. Absolute schoolboy glamour. When I looked down at the stopwatch and realized a split second before I permitted my face to show it or my voice to announce it, that Finney had broken a school record, I'd experienced a feeling that can also be described in one word: shock. To keep silent about this amazing happening deepened the shock for me. It made Finney seem too unusual for, not friendship, but too unusual for rivalry. And there were few relationships among us at Devon not based on rivalry. "Swimming in pools is screwy anyway," he said after a long, unusual silence as we walked toward the dormitory. "The only real swimming is in the ocean." Then, in the everyday, mediocre tone he used when he was proposing something really outrageous, he added, "Let's go to the beach." The beach was hours away by bicycle. Forbidden. Completely out of all bounds. Going there risked expulsion, destroyed the studying I was going to do for an important test the next morning, blasted the reasonable amount of order I wanted to maintain in my life, and it also involved the kind of long-labored bicycle ride I hated. "All right," I said. We got our bikes and slipped away from Devon along a back road. Having invited me, Finney now felt he had to keep me entertained. He told long, wild stories about his childhood. As I pumped, panting up steep hills, he glided along beside me, joking steadily. He analyzed my character, and he insisted on knowing what I disliked most about him. "You're too conventional," I said. He rode backward with no hands. He rode on his own handlebars. He jumped off and back on his moving bike as he'd seen trick horseback riders do in the movies. He sang. Despite the steady musical undertone in his speaking voice, Finney couldn't carry a tune, and he couldn't remember the melody or the words to any song. But he loved listening to music, any music, and he liked to sing. We reached the beach late in the afternoon. The tide was high and the surf was heavy. I dived in and rode a couple of waves, but they'd reached that stage of power in which you could feel the whole strength of the ocean in them. The second wave, as it tore toward the beach with me, spewed me a little ahead of it, encroaching rapidly. Suddenly it was immeasurably bigger than I was. It rushed me from the control of gravity and took control of me itself. The wave threw me down in a primitive plunge without a bottom. Then there was a bottom, grinding sand, and I skidded onto the shore. The wave hesitated, balanced there, and then hissed back toward the deep water, its tentacles not quite interested enough in me to drag me with it. I made my way up on the beach and lay down. Finney came, ceremoniously took my pulse, and then went back into the ocean. He stayed in an hour, breaking off every few minutes to come back to me and talk. The sand was so hot from the all-day sunshine that I had to brush the top layer away in order to lie down on it, and Finney's progress across the beach became a series of high, startled leaps. The ocean, throwing up foaming sun sprays across some nearby rocks, was winter cold. This kind of sunshine and ocean, with the accumulating roar of the surf and the salty, adventurous, flirting wind from the sea, always intoxicated Phineas. He was everywhere. He enjoyed himself hugely. He laughed out loud at passing seagulls.
and he did everything he could think of for me. We had dinner at a hot dog stand, with our backs to the ocean and its now cooler wind, our faces toward the heat of the cooking range. Then we walked on toward the center of the beach, where there was a subdued New England strip of honky-tonks. The boardwalk lights against the deepening blue sky gained an ideal, starry beauty, and the lights from the belt of honky-tonks and shooting galleries and beer gardens gleamed with a quiet purity in the clear twilight. Finney and I went along the boardwalk in our sneakers and white slacks, Finney in a light blue polo shirt and I in a t-shirt. I noticed that people were looking fixedly at him, so I took a look myself to see why. His skin radiated a reddish copper glow of tan. His brown hair had been a little bleached by the sun, and I noticed that the tan made his eyes shine with a cool blue-green fire. "Everybody's staring at you," he suddenly said to me. "It's because of that movie star tan you picked up this afternoon. Showing off again." Enough broken rules were enough that night. Neither of us suggested going into any of the honky-tonks or beer gardens. We did have one glass of beer each at a fairly respectable-looking bar, convincing or seeming to convince the bartender that we were old enough by a show of forged draft cards. Then we found a good spot among some sand dunes at the lonely end of the beach, and there we settled down to sleep for the night. The last words of Finney's usual nighttime monologue were, "I hope you're having a pretty good time here. I know I kind of dragged you away at the point of a gun, but after all, you can't come to the shore with just anybody, and you can't come by yourself, and at this teenage period in life, the proper person is your best pal." He hesitated and then added, "Which is what you are." And there was silence on his dune. It was a courageous thing to say. Exposing a sincere emotion nakedly like that at the Devon School was the next thing to suicide. I should have told him then that he was my best friend also, and rounded off what he had said. I started to. I nearly did. But something held me back. Perhaps I was stopped by that level of feeling, deeper than thought, which contains the truth. Chapter 4. The next morning I saw dawn for the first time. It began not as the gorgeous fanfare over the ocean I had expected, but as a strange gray thing, like sunshine seen through burlap. I looked over to see if Phineas was awake. He was still asleep, although in this drained light he looked more dead than asleep. The ocean looked dead too. Dead gray waves hissing mordantly along the beach, which was gray and dead-looking itself. I turned over and tried to sleep again, but couldn't, and so lay on my back, looking at this gray burlap sky. Very gradually, like one instrument after another being tentatively rehearsed, beacons of color began to pierce the sky. The ocean perked up a little from the reflection of these colored slivers in the sky. Bright highlights shone on the tips of waves, and beneath its gray surface I could see lurking a deep midnight green. The beach shed its deadness and became a spectral gray-white, then more white than gray, and finally it was totally white and stainless, as pure as the shores of Eden. Phineas, still asleep on his dune, made me think of Lazarus, brought back to life by the touch of God. I didn't contemplate this transformation for long. Inside my head, for as long as I could remember, there had always been a sense of time ticking steadily. I looked at the sky and the ocean and knew that it was around 6:30. The ride back to Devon would take 3 hours at least. My important test, trigonometry, was going to be held at 10 o'clock. Phineas woke up talking. "That was one of the best nights' sleep I ever had." "When did you ever have a bad one?" "The time I broke my ankle in football." "I like the way this beach looks now. Shall we have a morning swim?" "Are you crazy? It's too late for that." "What time is it anyway?" Finney knew I was a walking clock. It's going on 7 o'clock. There's time for just a short swim. And before I could say anything, he was trotting down the beach, shedding clothes as he went, and into the ocean. I waited for him where I was. He came back after a while, full of chilly glow and energy and talk. I didn't have much to say. "Do you have the money?" I asked once, suddenly suspecting that he'd lost our joint 75 cents during the night. There was a search, a hopeless one, in the sand, and so we set off on the long ride back without any breakfast, and got to Devon just in time for my test. I flunked it. I knew I was going to as soon as I looked at the test problems. It was the first test I had ever flunked. But Finney gave me little time to worry about that. Right after lunch, there was a game of blitzball, which took most of the afternoon, and right after dinner, there was the meeting of the Super Suicide Society of the summer session. That night in our room, even though I was worn out from all the exercise, I tried to catch up to what had been happening in trigonometry. "You work too hard," Finney said, sitting opposite me at the table where we read. The study lamp cast a round yellow pool between us. "You know all about history and English and French and everything else. What good will trigonometry do you?" "I'll have to pass it to graduate, for one thing." "Don't give me that line. Nobody at Devon has ever been surer of graduating than you are. You aren't working for that. You want to be head of the class, valedictorian, so you can make a speech on graduation day. In Latin or something boring like that, probably. And be the boy wonder of the school. I know you. Don't be stupid. I wouldn't waste my time on anything like that." "You never waste your time. That's why I have to do it for you." "Anyway," I grudgingly added, "somebody's got to be the head of the class." "You see, I knew that's what you were aiming at," he concluded quietly. Phooey. What if I was? It was a pretty good goal to have, it seemed to me. After all, he should talk. He'd won and been proud to win the Galbraith Football Trophy and the Contact Sport Award, and there were 2 or 3 other athletic prizes he was sure to get this year or next. If I was head of the class on graduation day, and made a speech, and won the Ne Plus Ultra Scholastic Achievement Citation, then we'd both have come out on top. We'd be even, that was all. We'd be even. Was that it? My eyes snapped from the textbook toward him. Did he notice this sudden glance shot across the pool of light? He didn't seem to. He went on writing down his strange curlicue notes about Thomas Hardy and Phineas Shorthand. Was that it? With his head bent over in the lamplight, I could discern a slight mound in his brow above the eyebrows, the faint bulge which is usually believed to indicate mental power. Phineas would be the first to disclaim any great mental power in himself. But what did go on in his mind? If I was the head of the class and won that prize, then we'd be even. His head started to come up, and mine snapped down. I glared at the textbook. "Relax," he said. "Your brain'll explode if you keep this up. You don't need to worry about me, Finney." "I'm not worried." "You wouldn't..." I wasn't sure I had the control to put this question. "Mind if I wound up head of the class, would you?" "Mind?" 2 clear green-blue eyes looked at me. "Fat chance you've got, anyway, with Chet Douglas around." "But you wouldn't mind, would you?" I repeated in a lower and more distinct voice. He gave me that half-smile of his which had won him 1,000 conflicts. "I'd kill myself out of jealous envy." I believed him. The joking manner was a screen. I believed him. In front of my eyes, the trigonometry textbook blurred into a jumble. I couldn't see. My brain exploded. He minded, despised the possibility that I might be the head of the school. There was a swift chain of explosions in my brain, one certainty after another blasted. Up like a detonation went the idea of any best friend. Up went affection and partnership and sticking by someone and relying on someone absolutely in the jungle of a boys' school. Up went the hope that there was anyone in this school, in this world, whom I could trust. Chet Douglas, I said uncertainly, is a sure thing for it. My misery was too deep to speak anymore. I scanned the page. I was having trouble breathing, as though the oxygen were leaving the room. Amid its devastation, my mind flashed from thought to thought, despairingly in search of something left which it could rely on. Not rely on absolutely, that was obliterated as a possibility. Just rely on a little, some solace, something surviving in the ruins. I found it. I found a single sustaining thought. The thought was, you and Phineas are even already. You are even in enmity. You're both coldly driving ahead for yourselves alone. You did hate him for breaking that school swimming record, but so what? He hated you for getting an A in every course but one last term. You would have had an A in that one except for him. Except for him. Then a second realization broke as clearly and bleakly as dawn at the beach. Finney had deliberately set out to wreck my studies. That explained Blitzball. That explained the nightly meetings of the Super Suicide Society. That explained his insistence that I share all his diversions. The way I believed that, you're my best friend, Blabber. The shadow falling across his face if I didn't want to do something with him. His instinct for sharing everything with me? Sure he wanted to share everything with me, especially his procession of D's in every subject. That way he, the great athlete, would be way ahead of me. It was all cold trickery. It was all calculated. It was all enmity. I felt better. Yes, I sensed it like the sweat of relief when nausea passes away. I felt better. We were even after all, even in enmity. The deadly rivalry was on both sides after all. I became quite a student after that. I'd always been a good one, although I wasn't really interested and excited by learning itself, the way Chet Douglas was. Now I became not just good, but exceptional, with Chet Douglas my only rival in sight. But I began to see that Chet was weakened by the very genuineness of his interest in learning. He got carried away by things. For example, he was so fascinated by the tilting planes of solid geometry that he did almost as badly in trigonometry as I did myself. When we read Candide, it opened up a new way of looking at the world to Chet, and he continued hungrily reading Voltaire in French while the class went on to other people. He was vulnerable there, because to me they were all pretty much alike, Voltaire and Molière, and the laws of motion and the Magna Carta, and the pathetic fallacy and tests of the d'Urbervilles. And I worked indiscriminately on all of them. Finney had no way of knowing this, because it all happened so far ahead of him scholastically. In class, he generally sat slouched in his chair, his alert face following the discussion with an expression of philosophical comprehension. And when he was forced to speak himself, the hypnotic power of his voice combined with the singularity of his mind to produce answers which were often not right, but could barely be branded as wrong. Written tests were his downfall, because he couldn't speak them, and as a result he got grades which were barely passing. It wasn't that he never worked, because he did work, in short, intense bouts now and then. As that crucial summer wore on, and I tightened the discipline on myself, Phineas increased his bouts of studying. I could see through that. I was more and more certainly becoming the best student in the school. Phineas was, without question, the best athlete. So in that way, we were even. But while he was a very poor student, I was a pretty good athlete. And when everything was thrown into the scales, they would, in the end, tilt definitely toward me. The new attacks of studying were his emergency measures to save himself. I redoubled my effort. It was surprising how well we got along in these weeks. Sometimes I found it hard to remember his treachery. Sometimes I discovered myself thoughtlessly slipping back into affection for him again. It was hard to remember when one summer day after another broke with a cool effulgence over us, and there was a breath of widening life in the morning air, something hard to describe. An oxygen intoxicant, a shining northern paganism. Some odor, some feeling so hopelessly promising that I would fall back in my bed on guard against it. It was hard to remember in the heady and sensual clarity of these mornings. I forgot whom I hated and who hated me. I wanted to break out crying from stabs of hopeless joy, or intolerable promise, or because these mornings were too full of beauty for me, because I knew of too much hate to be contained in a world like this. Summer lazed on. No one paid any attention to us. One day, I found myself describing to Mr. Prudhomme how Phineas and I had slept on the beach, and he seemed to be quite interested in it, in all the details. So much so that he missed the point, that we had flatly broken a basic rule. No one cared. No one exercised any real discipline over us. We were on our own. August arrived with a deepening of the summertime splendors of New Hampshire. Early in the month we had 2 days of light, steady rain, which aroused a final fullness everywhere. The branches of the old trees, which had been familiar to me either half-denuded or completely gaunt during the winter terms at Devon, now seemed about to break from their storms of leaves. Little disregarded patches of ground revealed that they had been gardens all along, and nondescript underbrush around the gymnasium and the river broke into color. There was a latent freshness in the air, as though spring were returning in the middle of the summer. But examinations were at hand. I wasn't as ready for them as I wanted to be. The Suicide Society continued to meet every evening, and I continued to attend, because I didn't want Finney to understand me as I understood him. And also, I didn't want to let him excel me in this, even though I knew that it didn't matter whether he showed me up at the tree or not, because it was what you had in your heart that counted. And I had detected that Finney's was a den of lonely, selfish ambition. He was no better than I was, no matter who won all the contests. A French examination was announced for one Friday late in August. Finney and I studied for it in the library Thursday afternoon. I went over vocabulary lists, and he wrote messages. Je ne give a damn pas about le français. Les filles en France ne wear pas les pantalons, and passed them with great seriousness to me as aide-mémoire. Of course, I didn't get any work done. After supper, I went to our room to try again. Phineas came in a couple of minutes later. Arise, he began airily. Senior Overseer Charter Member, Elwyn Leper Lepelier has announced his intention to make the leap this very night, to qualify, to save his face at last. I didn't believe it for a second. Leper Lepelier would go down paralyzed with panic on any sinking troop ship before making such a jump. Finney had put him up to it, to finish me for good on the exam. I turned around with elaborate resignation. If he jumps out of that tree, I'm Mahatma Gandhi. All right, agreed Finney absently. He had a way of turning clichés inside out like that. Come on, let's go. We've got to be there. You never know. Maybe he will do it this time. Oh, for God's sake. I slammed closed the French book. What's the matter? What a performance. His face was completely questioning and candid. Studying, I snarled. Studying, you know, books, work, examinations. Yeah. He waited for me to go on, as though he didn't see what I was getting at. Oh, for God's sake, you don't know what I'm talking about. No, of course not. Not you. I stood up and slammed the chair against the desk. Okay, we go. We watch little Lily Liver Lepelier not jump from the tree, and I ruin my grade. He looked at me with an interested, surprised expression. You want to study? I began to feel a little uneasy at this mildness of his, so I sighed heavily. Never mind, forget it. I know, I joined the club, I'm going. What else can I do? Don't go. He said it very simply and casually. As though he were saying, nice day. He shrugged. Don't go. What the hell? It's only a game. I'd stopped halfway across the room, and now I just looked at him. "What do you mean?" I muttered. What he meant was clear enough, but I was groping for what lay behind his words, for what his thoughts could possibly be. I might have asked, "Who are you, then?" instead. I was facing a total stranger. "I didn't know you needed to study," he said simply. "I didn't think you ever did. I thought it just came to you." It seemed that he'd made some kind of parallel between my studies and his sports. He probably thought anything you were good at came without effort. He didn't know yet that he was unique. I couldn't quite achieve a normal speaking voice. "If I need to study, then so do you." "Me?" he smiled faintly. "Listen, I could study forever and I'd never break C. But it's different for you. You're good. You really are. If I had a brain like that, I'd have my head cut open so people could look at it." "Now wait a second." He put his hands on the back of a chair and leaned toward me. "I know. We kid around a lot and everything. But you have to be serious sometime about something. If you're really good at something, I mean, if there's nobody, or hardly anybody, who's as good at it as you are, then you've got to be serious about that. Don't mess around, for God's sake." He frowned disapprovingly at me. "Why didn't you say you had to study before? Don't move from that desk. It's going to be all A's for you." "Wait a minute," I said, without any reason. "It's okay. I'll oversee old leper. I know he's not going to do it." He was at the door. "Wait a minute," I said more sharply. "Wait just a minute. I'm coming." "No, you aren't, pal. You're going to study." "Never mind my studying. You think you've done enough already?" "Yes." I let this drop curtly to bar him from telling me what to do about my work. He let it go at that and went out the door ahead of me, whistling off key. We followed our gigantic shadows across the campus, and Phineas began talking in wild French to give me a little extra practice. I said nothing, my mind exploring the new dimensions of isolation around me. Any fear I had ever had of the tree was nothing beside this. It wasn't my neck, but my understanding which was menaced. He'd never been jealous of me for a second. Now I knew that there never was and never could have been any rivalry between us. I was not of the same quality as he. I couldn't stand this. We reached the others, loitering around the base of the tree, and Phineas began exuberantly to throw off his clothes, delighted by the fading glow of the day, the challenge of the tree, the competitive tension of all of us. He lived and flourished in such moments. "Let's go, you and me," he called. A new idea struck him. "We'll go together. A double jump. Neat, eh?" None of this mattered now. I would have listlessly agreed to anything. He started up the wooden rungs, and I began climbing behind, up to the limb high over the bank. Phineas ventured a little way along it, holding a thin nearby branch for support. "Come out a little way," he said, "and then we'll jump side by side." The countryside was striking from here, a deep green sweep of playing fields and bordering shrubbery, with the school stadium white and miniature looking across the river. From behind us, the last long rays of light played across the campus, accenting every slight undulation of the land, emphasizing the separateness of each bush. Holding firmly to the trunk, I took a step toward him. And then my knees bent, and I jounced the limb. Finney, his balance gone, swung his head around to look at me for an instant with extreme interest, and then he tumbled sideways, broke through the little branches below, and hit the bank with a sickening, unnatural thud. It was the first clumsy physical action I had ever seen him make. With unthinking sureness, I moved out on the limb and jumped into the river, every trace of my fear of this forgotten. Chapter 5. None of us was allowed near the infirmary during the next days, but I heard all the rumors that came out of it. Eventually, a fact emerged. It was one of his legs, which had been shattered. I couldn't figure out exactly what this word meant, whether it meant broken in one or several places, cleanly or badly, and I didn't ask. I learned no more, although the subject was discussed endlessly. Out of my hearing, people must have talked of other things, but everyone talked about Phineas to me. I suppose this was only natural. I'd been right beside him when it happened. I was his roommate. The effect of his injury on the masters seemed deeper than after other disasters I remembered there. It was as though they felt it was especially unfair that it should strike one of the 16-year-olds, one of the few young men who could be free and happy in the summer of 1942. I couldn't go on hearing about it much longer. If anyone had been suspicious of me, I might have developed some strength to defend myself. But there was nothing. No one suspected. Phineas must still be too sick, or too noble, to tell them. I spent as much time as I could alone in our room, trying to empty my mind of every thought, to forget where I was, even who I was. One evening, when I was dressing for dinner in this numbed frame of mind, an idea occurred to me, the first with any energy behind it since Fenny fell from the tree. I decided to put on his clothes. We wore the same size, and although he always criticized mine, he used to wear them frequently, quickly forgetting what belonged to him and what to me. I never forgot. And that evening I put on his Cordovan shoes, his pants, and I looked for and finally found his pink shirt, neatly laundered in a drawer. Its high, somewhat stiff collar against my neck, the wide cuffs touching my wrists, the rich material against my skin excited a sense of strangeness and distinction. I felt like some nobleman, some Spanish grandee. But when I looked in the mirror, it was no remote aristocrat I'd become, no character out of daydreams. I was Phineas, Phineas to the life. I even had his humorous expression on my face, his sharp, optimistic awareness. I had no idea why this gave me such intense relief, but it seemed, standing there in Finney's triumphant shirt, that I would never stumble through the confusions of my own character again. I didn't go down to dinner. The sense of transformation stayed with me throughout the evening, and even when I undressed and went to bed. That night I slept easily, and it was only on waking up that this illusion was gone, and I was confronted with myself and what I had done to Finney. Sooner or later it had to happen, and that morning it did. "Finney's better," Dr. Stanpole called to me on the chapel steps over the organ recessional thundering behind us. I made my way haltingly past the members of the choir, with their black robes flapping in the morning breeze, the doctor's words reverberating around me. He might denounce me there before the whole school. Instead, he steered me amiably into the lane leading toward the infirmary. He could stand a visitor or two now, after these very nasty few days. "You don't think I'll upset him or anything?" "You? No, why? I don't want any of these teachers flapping around him, but a pal or two, it'll do him good." "I suppose he's still pretty sick." "It was a messy break." "But how is he feeling? I mean, is he cheerful at all, or—" "Oh, you know Finney." I didn't. I was pretty sure I didn't know Finney at all. "It was a messy break," he went on. "But we'll have him out of it eventually. He'll be walking again."
"Walking again?"
"Yes." The doctor didn't look at me, and barely changed his tone of voice. "Sports are finished for him, after an accident like that, of course."
"But he must be able to," I burst out. "If his leg's still there, if you aren't going to amputate it—"
"You aren't, are you?
Then if it isn't amputated, and the bones are still there, then it must come back the way it was. Why wouldn't it? Of course it will."
Dr. Stanpole hesitated, and I think glanced at me for a moment. "Sports are finished. As a friend, you ought to help him face that and accept it. The sooner he does, the better off he'll be. If I had the slightest hope that he could do more than walk, I'd be all for trying for everything. There is no such hope. I'm sorry, as of course everyone is. It's a tragedy, but there it is." I grabbed my head, fingers digging into my skin, and the doctor, thinking to be kind, put his hand on my shoulder. At his touch, I lost all hope of controlling myself. I burst out, crying into my hands. I cried for Phineas, and for myself, and for this doctor who believed in facing things. Most of all, I cried because of kindness, which I had not expected. Now, that's no good. You've got to be cheerful and hopeful. He needs that from you. He wanted especially to see you. You were the one person he asked for. That stopped my tears. I brought my hands down and watched the red brick exterior of the infirmary, a cheerful building, coming closer. Of course I was the first person he wanted to see. Phineas would say nothing behind my back. He would accuse me, face to face. We were walking up the steps of the infirmary. Everything was very swift. And next, I was in a corridor, being nudged by Dr. Stanpole toward the door. "He's in there. I'll be with you in a minute." The door was slightly ajar, and I pushed it back and stood transfixed on the threshold. Phineas lay among pillows and sheets, his left leg, enormous in its white bindings, suspended a little above the bed. A tube led from a glass bottle into his right arm. Some channel began to close inside me, and I knew I was about to black out. "Come on in," I heard him say. "You look worse than I do." The fact that he could still make a light remark pulled me back a little, and I went to a chair beside his bed. He seemed to have diminished physically in the few days which had passed, and to have lost his tan. His eyes studied me as though I were the patient. They no longer had their sharp good humor, but had become clouded and visionary. After a while, I realized he'd been given a drug. "What are you looking so sick about?" he went on. "Finny, I..." There was no controlling what I said. The words were instinctive, like the reactions of someone cornered. "What happened there at the tree? That goddamn tree? I'm gonna cut down that tree. Who cares who can jump out of it? What happened? What happened? How did you fall? How could you fall off like that?" "I just fell." His eyes were vaguely on my face. "Something jiggled, and I fell over. I remember I turned around and looked at you. It was like I had all the time in the world. I thought I could reach out and get hold of you." I flinched violently away from him. "To drag me down, too?" He kept looking vaguely over my face. "To get hold of you so I wouldn't fall off." "Yeah, naturally." I was fighting for air in this close room. "I tried, you remember? I reached out, but you were gone. You went down through those little branches underneath, and when I reached out, there was only air. I just remember looking at your face for a second. Awfully funny expression you had. Very shocked, like you have right now." "Right now? Well, of course, I am shocked. Who wouldn't be shocked, for God's sake? It's terrible. Everything's terrible." "But I don't see why you should look so personally shocked. You look like it happened to you or something." "It's almost like it did. I was right there, right on the limb beside you." "Yeah, I know. I remember it all." There was a hard block of silence, and then I said quietly, as though my words might detonate the room, "Do you remember what made you fall?" His eyes continued their roaming across my face. "I don't know. I must have just lost my balance. It must have been that. I did have this idea, this feeling, that when you were standing there beside me, you... I don't know. I had a kind of feeling. But you can't say anything for sure from just feelings. And this feeling doesn't make any sense. It was a crazy idea. I must have been delirious. So I just have to forget it. I just fell." He turned away to grope for something among the pillows. "That's all." Then he glanced back at me. "I'm sorry about that feeling I had." I couldn't say anything to this sincere drugged apology for having suspected the truth. He was never going to accuse me. It was only a feeling he had, and at this moment he must have been formulating a new commandment in his personal decalogue. Never accuse a friend of a crime if you only have a feeling he did it. And I thought we were competitors. It was so ludicrous I wanted to cry. If Phineas had been sitting here in this pool of guilt, how would he have felt? What would he have done? He would have told me the truth. I got up so suddenly that the chair overturned. I stared at him in amazement, and he stared back, his mouth breaking into a grin as the moments passed. "Well," he said at last in his friendly, knowing voice, "what are you going to do? Hypnotize me?" "Finny, I've got something to tell you. You're going to hate it, but there's something I've got to tell you." "My God, what energy," he said, falling back against the pillows. "You sound like General MacArthur." "I don't care who I sound like, and you won't think so when I tell you. This is the worst thing in the world, and I'm sorry, and I hate to tell you, but I've got to tell you." But I didn't tell him. Dr. Stanpole came in before I was able to, and then a nurse came in, and I was sent away. The next day the doctor decided that Finney was not yet well enough to see visitors, even old pals like me. Soon after, he was taken in an ambulance to his home outside Boston. The summer session closed, officially came to an end. But to me, it seemed irresolutely suspended, halted strangely before its time. I went south for a month's vacation in my hometown and spent it in an atmosphere of reverie and unreality, as though I had lived that month once already and had not been interested by it the first time either. At the end of September, I started back toward Devon on the jammed, erratic trains of September, 1942. I reached Boston 17 hours behind schedule. There would be prestige in that at Devon, where those of us from long distances with travel adventures to report or invent held the floor for several days after a vacation. By luck, I got a taxi at South Station, and instead of saying North Station to the driver, instead of just crossing Boston and catching the final train for the short last leg of the trip to Devon. Instead of that, I sat back in the seat and heard myself give the address of Finney's house on the outskirts. We found it fairly easily, on a street with a nave of ancient elms branching over it. The house itself was high, white, and oddly proper to be the home of Phineas. It presented a face of definite elegance to the street, although behind that, wings and ells dwindled quickly in formality until the house ended in a big, plain barn. Nothing surprised Phineas. A cleaning woman answered the door, and when I came into the room where he was sitting, he looked very pleased and not at all surprised. "So you are going to show up," his voice took off in one of its flights. "And you brought me something to eat from down south, didn't you? Honeysuckle and molasses or something like that." I tried to think of something funny. "Cornbread? You did bring something. You didn't go all the way to Dixie and then come back with nothing but your dismal face to show for it." His talk.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.